So I just want to speak briefly about a note that I got this morning and a few notes that I've gotten about this. And I won't say a lot about it, but I will definitely address it. And that is, what is this Dharma? What does Dharma mean? You know, I like that we're at Southern Dharma, not at the Southern Center for Buddhist Studies. Mm-hmm. It's very different. First, I want to say, don't worry about what it means. Nobody knows what it means, which is why it's such a cool word. It would mean something similar to like the word spirituality. What is spirituality? Yeah, whatever you think it is. But Dharma is a couple things I can say about it. It's a Pali word and a Sanskrit word. The Dharma is the Sanskrit. Pali is Dhamma. So the Buddha taught the Dhamma in the most earliest sense. So in the earliest sense, the Dhamma is what was taught by the historic figure Siddhartha Gautama. It's what he taught was Dhamma. Buddhism is very different. So I'll politely put that aside. Buddhism is a world religion in which there's many different schools and different studies, and not all Buddhisms agree on the Dhamma. It's a big kind of academic kind of mess. Which I consider myself a friend of Buddhism. I don't feel very comfortable. I don't really identify as a Buddhist, frankly. But the word Dharma means actually, I would say that I have a religious relationship to the word Dharma, Dhamma. Right. So it's what the Buddha taught. Another way to say it in a more kind of philosophical way or psychological dimension of it is it's how things come to be. Sometimes I get confused when people think the Dharma is an explanation of the way things are. Things aren't a certain way. So Dharma is talking about things that are in constant flux and impermanence and process. It's how do things come to be? How does the sound of that bird come to be? Well, there needs to be an object. There needs to be a bird making a sound. There needs to be the organ of the ear. There needs to be contact with that sound, and then the consciousness of that sound arises, and the hearing arises. So, ultimately, consciousness is a phenomenological event. And so that's how that comes to be. And the Dharma is an exploration of how many things, maybe thousands of different things, come to be. How does human flourishing come to be? How does joy come to be? How does kindness come to be? How does anger? How does disappointment? How does resentment come to be? Everything comes to be through a series of causes and conditions. And in Dharma practice, we try to practice in a way. So the exploration, the practice of Dharma, I think at its most foundational is a practice of ethics. It's not an ontological understanding of how things are, but it's an exploration for how do we do well as humans? How do we make this life mean something to us? That's probably the most pragmatic way of thinking about it. So there's as many Dharma practices as there are people sitting in this room. And the Buddha said time and time again, may no two of you follow the same path. So kind of in a cool way, it's kind of like whatever you think it is. Whatever it means to you is your Dharma, your Dhamma practice. My practice of liberation, my practice of human flourishing, my practice of overcoming my struggles. It could all be thought in that way. So I hope that helps. I don't want to say much more than that because I could go on and on and on. And again, it kind of doesn't matter. But we are really, when I think about the practice, of course, I will use words like Buddhism. I will use words like mindfulness. I will use a lot of different words. But for me, it's all under this umbrella term. It's all Dharma practice. And I really actually would even specifically in the work that I do in my mentoring programs, I don't even call it Dharma practice. I call it Dharma work. Because this feels, I don't know if you've noticed, but does this feel like work? This is work. There's an element to it that's practice. Practice sounds too light to me. Practice is like, I'm going to go practice some guitar skills, or I'm going to go practice baseball, play catch with my kids. This is not like that. This is work. It takes effort. So I'll just leave that there. I also have this recorded so you can always listen to it later. This morning is a mindfulness practice, awareness practice. We're going to kind of expand a little bit into what's called feeling. which is, I'll talk more about this because it's a tricky word in Pali. The Pali word is Vedana. It's a very important, maybe one of the most important ideas in how we relate to practice and experience in the word feeling or Vedana. In English, the word is, in Pali, I mean, in the Buddhist context, it's a much more narrowly defined. It's more of an affective intelligence, or how things affect us, how we're being touched by the moment. And we're being touched by the moment in ways that we like what's happening, or we don't like what's happening, and we're kind of ambiguous. Or in the most common way it's understood is that we experience moments of experiences being pleasant, unpleasant, and neither. Right, and that's kind of the general overview of that. In English, we use the word in too many different ways. Like, you know, I'm feeling like having Chinese instead of pizza. I'm feeling sad. I'm feeling angry. I'm feeling like... We use it in way too many wide range of ways. But in its etymology, Vedana means it encompasses both to feel and to know. So it's not just unpleasant pain in my knee. I feel that, but I also know that. I feel and I know what's going on. And this is it's also understood in Buddhist psychology that Vedana, like contact, like attention, is present in every single moment of experience. So we are kind of trapped in the feeling body, the nervous system body, the psychological body, the emotional body. We're feeling creatures. They use this word a lot of times called sentient. Sentient just means... organisms with senses. We have five physical senses. And then we have this other thing, number six, which is the troublemaker, the sensory experience of thinking. So from the early model of Buddhist psychology, the mind, thinking is just another organ that receives an object. Right? But think about how much do we privilege thinking over the other objects? In the modern world, we're kind of... That's the sense door. We're constantly lost and we're constantly thinking. But we don't necessarily notice that a thought has a tone. So we have physical Vedana, which would be kind of hedonic, pain-pleasure dichotomy. I like things that feel good. I don't like things that feel bad. Right? That's very hedonic. You know, like, and we don't have a lot of agency over that. We have very, very little agency over Vedana. Vedana is understood to happen sort of right before consciousness arises. So it gives consciousness the data and tells you, yeah, you don't like this, get rid of this, you don't want that. Or it says, get this, have this, you want this. So it happens pre-consciousness. So feeling Vedana is not your fault. There's nothing you can do about it. Right? If somebody kicks you in the leg, do you sit there and go, gee, I wonder if I like this or not? I don't know if this, does this feel pleasant? Or you just know, ouch, then you get mad and you're angry. And it's just like, it's built in. It's pre-conscious. Right? So a lot of times, one of the things that we do is we judge and we assess and we evaluate the quality of our life based on the feeling tone that's present in this moment. It's very interesting. It's the pen that writes the narrative of your life moment to moment. Think about it. You're in a bad mood one day. You wake up, you're in a bad mood. A bunch of terrible things happened yesterday. You're tired, you're grumpy. Things aren't going your way. This whole Dave Smith project is not going well. This is not going well. I'm not happy. Life isn't good. Life is bad. People don't really like me. I don't think actually my kids like me very much. Maybe I'm actually just kind of a bad person. I try to be nice and I try to be kind and I try to practice what I preach, but I don't think I'm actually doing that. Why? That all that is being informed by this unpleasant Vedana. It's giving data to the consciousness saying, yes, yes, and then I'm writing this story. Now, the next day I could wake up, got plenty of sleep, had some good coffee, got a couple of good emails, some things that I didn't think were going to happen are going to happen. All of a sudden, the Dave Smith Project is amazing. Right? I'm patting myself. I'm doing really good. I'm helping all these people. Really such a good guy. My kids love me. Where this is all being informed. It's like, so when you're in a good mood, when you're happy, you do well. And so, but this is all being informed. So we have to investigate. We have to look at this kind of things because it's what informs how we make meaning moment to moment to moment to moment. You know, I'm sure everybody yesterday had that moment. You're sitting here where your body's in pain and you're looking at the schedule going like, I have 3 more 45-minute sets. You're like, what was I thinking? And you're just sitting here, oh man, this is... And then you have that one sit or a couple moments where your body's not in pain and you're connected with the breathing and the hearing of the sounds. You're like, oh man, I'm totally meditating right now. Oh, yeah. Right? Which one of those experiences is true? Which one of those, you know, see, that's the process that happens, but it's the identification with experience that gets us. It's the over-identification with the experience and then what that we think that means about us as a person or individual living in this world. So a lot of it is so when there's feeling, there's also perception, and that's where that's the narrator. It's almost like a sporting event. You know, like there's a commentator giving you a play-by-play. You're not doing so good. You're doing the sit this morning was really good. You're doing much better at 10 o'clock. You're not doing so good now. It's just that constant assessment that we make. Very irritating. You're probably familiar with this aspect of your mind. And that's largely informed by Vedana, by how we feel. Right? So it's a very, very important and very, very crucial aspect of practice. So it's in every single moment. It also is... sense at every sense door. So we have pleasant smells and unpleasant smells and sights and sounds and tastes. So we're getting 6 variations of it. So we can kind of be bombarded. So there's 18 options, 6 sense doors, 3 feeling tones, 18. Right? And the thing that's so hard to overcome, and this really comes from the work of Rick Hansen and a lot of the people who are mindfulness practitioners, Dharma practitioners, who also study and are trained in neuroscience. And they say this is really what they call the negative attention bias, and this is really what we're up against as a species. This is more science than it is Dharma. And that attention has a bias. Attention, neurobiologically, is sort of by design, has a tendency to want to seek out the unpleasant. For survival. So it's not even a fair game. It's not even a blank slate. Your mind is predetermined and pre-programmed to look for the negative. Right? And you might have noticed this yesterday, like you're sitting here and there's a pain somewhere in the body, there's an ache in the body, and you just can't unhook from that, right? Oh man, I don't like to think of, you know, this retreat, it would be awesome if my back didn't hurt. It would be awesome if my mind would shut up for 2 seconds. Right. And so that's natural. That's kind of that, because in nature it's better to be safe than sorry. It's better for us, for survival, to walk into the woodshed and see the coil of rope and assume it's a snake. Right. And even if you're wrong 99 out of 100 times, it's worth it if it was a snake one time. The system is rigged against you. Right. So we have to work that much harder to not identify with the negativity, to not identify with the unpleasant, unwanted, disagreeable tonality of the experience. You know, it's like a clear glass. You know, if you take a glass of water and you take one drop of red, tiny little drop in a huge glass of water, and you put one drop in the cup of water, what happens to the water? It turns red. It's not even fair. It's like one drop ruined the whole glass. Like, yeah. So the mind is like that. The mind is never kind of clear like a clean glass. It always has these kind of sedimentations and these discolorations in it. There's kind of the unpleasant and then there's the pleasant. And the thing from a practice point of view that I really want to warn against, and I didn't teach Vedana for periods of time because I never felt like I was that skilled at it, is what happens for people is they go looking for it. Don't go looking for it. It's already here. And don't start thinking about it. The problem with Vedana practice is you go, do I feel pleasant? Unpleasant? If it's not obviously unpleasant or pleasant, it's just neither. That's a little hint for you. If you're not sure, neutral. They usually call it neutral, but it's not really neutral, it's neither. And most of life is neither. Most of life, in case you haven't noticed, I'm sure you have, life is a pretty ordinary experience. Most of it. You get up in the morning, you make your coffee, you kind of mope around the house, you look at your phone, whatever you do, drive to work. A lot of life is just kind of this mundane ordinariness, right? it's neutral probably more of the time than anything else. So usually when we're in neutrality or neither, the tendency is to get bored or to feel unsatisfied or dissatisfied. And then what happens is now you start manufacturing unpleasant Vedana in the mind. So you're taking an experience that was kind of neutral and ordinary, and now it's becoming a lot more unpleasant because we haven't been able to relate to it in a way. And so that would be that mental side of it. Right? And a lot of times what that would be is it's what's called craving for stimulation. This is okay, and it's fine to be here, and you know, I'm a little bored, okay, but it'd be really nice if. It's that wanting things to be, wanting the experience to be more pleasant. Wanting that stimulation, wanting something to taste, something to put in my mouth, something to hear, something to listen to, something to read. I mean, I'm sure since you've been here, you're like, oh, it'd be cool if I had some music to listen to, or a book to read, or a power bar, or something. and that's where that started. Just that wanting. And that's where, this is where, when we track, you know, if we look at kind of tracking the mind moment to moment, this is really the sweet spot of liberation, of being able to notice that wanting, noticing the mental kick on, and saying, actually, you know what? And that's the renunciation. I say, you know, I'm going to let that go. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to be dictated. I'm not going to let my mind be driven, because these are kind of, they're drivers. For our psychology is that, you know, there's a kind of the moment of wanting and then the moment of not wanting and then all of the thinking proliferation that happens around that. Right? And that's what gets us into so much trouble. Right? So we can catch that. So in mindfulness, yesterday we worked with simple awareness, which is very valuable, happens all the time. It's something you can continue to practice. But when we start to apply this a little bit more dynamic side of mindfulness to experience, it's called protective awareness, which is we're trying to protect the mind from being infiltrated and corrupted by this pleasure-pain dichotomy, by the wanting and the not wanting, by the liking and the not liking, by the, it'd be great if I had this, and it would be good if I could get rid of that. And part of Dharma is seeing how things come to be. Well, how do these things come to be? And as we watch the mind has behaviors. The mind has all kinds of behaviors. So thinking to me, I think of the mind as kind of more of a behavioral system than anything else. And when I watch my mind, and you've seen this, and it isn't actually hard to see, you don't have to be like the Zen master on the mountaintop to see this stuff, is if you start to watch your experience, you'll notice the mind is constantly like, it's trying to bring things in that would be pleasing. I want more of this and less of that. So the mind's kind of like already doing this. Like, you know, it's been doing it your whole life. It's not going to stop just because you sat down. It would be nice to get this. It's what I call grabbing and dropping, and that's how we. That's my kind of posture towards life. I look at my schedule, look at my life, and look, okay, these are the things that I want, and these are the things that I want to get rid of. And all of my mental energy, all of my behavioral energy, mostly is pushing me in that direction. Now, again, that's not bad. That's not wrong. That's not a problem. But it gets out of hand, right? It gets way out of hand, way fast. It might take 7 or 8 seconds to be like, you know, I'd be really happy right now if. And then we disconnect from this experience, and we take birth in this kind of other experience, this imagined experience. And again, we time travel, and the body's still here going, yeah, that would be kind of cool, actually, but can't do it. And then we create that sense of separation, tension, and then we suffer. Because you're wanting something that actually can't be done. And that's really, really, to be able to see this, to be able to kind of witness this and intervene on this process is a liberation practice. It's really going for, like, it really investigates this. Right? So this protective awareness, another way to say it in a more kind of a clinical sense, maybe would be the word I would use, is that those who have been in therapy or done therapy or therapists, they use a word a lot in the clinical domain called affect. What is the affect? Not affect with an E, but affect with an A. I am affected. So something happens in my life. Well, how did that affect you? Oh, it was a big loss, and it really, really made me sad. And it was really, really hard. It was very unpleasant. So we have these kind of, your life, all of you have been alive for quite a while now. Have you noticed you've been affected by the things that have happened? Right? And that's just how it goes. So we have, there's a lot of wisdom in understanding the affect of the experience, but not letting the affect of your experience define the experience. Or define the story or the narrative of what it means to be you, which is really where the other aspect that gets, I'll speak about this more tomorrow, which is perception, is how we perceive and how we story make and how we get caught and we create these narratives about who and what we are, which is based on this not really good data. But again, these, as consciousness emerges, these are the building blocks of experience. This is kind of what happens. We don't have any say over Vedana. I mean, you'll notice this in life. Something will happen and it affects you. You don't get to decide how it affects you. Another way they think they talk about this in the canon, which I like, is the Buddha talks about mindfulness as the gatekeeper. And he talks about it being kind of the mind and the heart is kind of like a city with six entrances, right? And so what we want to do is we want to protect the integrity and the safety of the city of our heart and mind by having a gatekeeper at each of these gates that is there and is mindful about what's coming into the city, right? So it's trying to protect, and so that's that protective awareness. Okay, like something's coming in that we know this is very unpleasant. We need to be careful with this. This is an unpleasant feeling. This is an unpleasant thought. We know that if we don't have awareness and we don't have some wisdom around this, this will corrupt the city. Right? So mindfulness as sort of the gatekeeper. Now, like most cities and like most countries, we can't stop everything from getting in. Right? But we just can kind of keep an eye on it, right? Like I'll notice if I wake up, you know, if I don't say, you know, I have small children at home. You know, I'll stay up. I'll watch two or three too many Netflix shows. I'll go to bed tired. I'll have a poor night's sleep. I'll wake up too early. I won't get up early enough. I'll get up at the same time as my kids, and then I gotta let my dogs out, and I'm already feeling very unpleasant. Right, and then that is kind of driving, and then I start to getting. Frustrated or judgmental, or I get hurried, which I think is one of the most destructive mind states. You ever feel hurried? Mm-hmm. It's not good. Now I feel hurried, now I feel behind, now I'm behind the eight ball, now the kids aren't getting their shoes on quick enough. I'm getting angry, getting irritated, and it's just like, but the gatekeeper's not doing his job. He's not saying, hey, dude, be careful. You know, you didn't get a lot of sleep. You're grumpy. You're irritated. You need to be careful. You need to be extra careful about what you say and what you do and how you act and how you behave because, you know, there's a lot of this unpleasantness going on. And it's going to go, and it's a driver of experience. It's going to drive what I say. It's going to drive what I do. It's going to drive what I think. Going to drive myself. You know, I'm an idiot. I knew better. I should have gone to sleep last night. I shouldn't have watched four episodes of Ozarks, but it was so good. And they do that cliffhanger at the end. They always suck you into the next one, don't they? Mm-hmm. I'm mad at the people who made Ozarks. You know, I'm mad at everything now. And it's just like, and I've been awake for 5 minutes. And the whole day is basically ruined in my mind. Right? So I'm not protecting myself. I'm not being aware of this. I'm not trying to feel into this and have more kindness and say, well, yeah, today might be a hard day and like maybe you didn't make the best choices yesterday, but let's make the best of it. Let's make the best of it. You know? And that is not my, I'm not naturally drawn towards that. That's not my nature. My nature isn't to be forgiving and kind and say, don't worry, take it easy on myself. Take it easy on your kids. If they're late for school, it's not the end of the world. No, that's not, I have to work my ass off to get into that space, right? But I notice it's worth it. The work is worth it, because when I get into that space, everybody, myself and the people who are around me, it's a much better experience for everybody. Because my, if I can't handle my unpleasant Vedana, it's going to spill over on you. It's going to spill over on my kids. It's going to spill over on everybody. Right? And then we have this huge concoction. Anybody here have small children? Go places with the small children. You know, the car ride can be kind of the cocktail of unpleasant Vedana. You know, it's just like everybody's unpleasantness is kind of just, and it's just kind of brooding and brooding and brooding. So we don't have agency over it. It's a little bit pre-conscious. So again, now we're really into what I'm a huge proponent of, and I will revisit over and over again. It's a relationship game now. What kind of a relationship can I bring to how I feel? Can I bring more kindness and more empathy and more care and more understanding to the fact that I'm a little bit in pain right now? I'm having a hard moment. I'm having a hard sit. This is a hard sit. This is going to go down. This is going to get chalked up in the hard sit category. Okay? Well, if that's how it's being right now, can I at least be more aware of and change my relationship to kind of how I'm experiencing this moment? Right. And that's work. So that's what we're trying to do. We don't want to let the feeling tonality of the experience dictate the experience, which is what it generally does. We want to be empowered to say, no, this is not the end of the story. This is not the story I'm going to. This is not how I'm going to live out the next 30 minutes. Putting my foot down. And as we'll talk about this tomorrow, what this gives rise to is really one of the three things that the Buddha really is trying to liberate us from, which is greed, hatred, and confusion. Or I would say greed, hatred, and fear. So the pleasantness, the inclination towards grabbing the pleasantness gives rise to this mental quality of greed, of wanting at any cost, wanting to get to have at any cost. Greed, wanting, gotta have, gotta get. Addiction, kind of grabbing in the mind, which a lot of times, if we get too greedy, if we want it too bad, we'll start to do things that go against our better judgment, our better values. Greed is the mental factor that will allow us and encourage us to put our ethics aside for the moment. And then hatred, the not wanting. I'll do anything I can to get rid of this, to change this, to avoid this. Right? And then they usually use the word delusion, which I think you shouldn't use that word. I don't think it's the right term. I think it's fear or confusion, but I think it's really fear. Because there's what I want, there's what I don't want, and then there's the fear that I'm not going to get what I want, and I'm going to get what I don't want. Mm. And that's largely the experience in which we find ourselves, moment to moment. I want this, and I don't want that, and I'm afraid I'm not going to get this, and I'm afraid I'm going to get that. Right? So if you really want to hone your dharma, those are really the Buddha thing. Be aware of this, right? If there's one teaching, if there's one practice that you want to take on, be aware of this, be aware of the feelings, be aware of the grabbing, of the dropping, and then of the burning that happens when we got to have and we got to get rid of. If you just did that today, I guarantee you would be very busy. Very busy. Speaking of which, let's do it. So I'll stop there.